Succession number 11735, Lois Hoskins, reel 1 of 2.
Hoskins, reel 1. And Lois, could I ask you first of all something about your background in America? You know, were you brought up, for instance, in a Quaker family?
Yes, I was. And I had three brothers who all declared their conscientious objection to war at the time of the Second World War and went into the civilian public service camps. One of the brothers was in the Forest Service, seconded, and became a smoke jumper, which was a much more interesting way of spending the time. And one of the brothers was in Texas in the non-combatant ranks of the medical corps and spent his whole time in Texas and didn't have a very interesting time, but it got him into med school afterwards, so he made a good life of his convictions. The one who was the smoke jumper later went to Italy to help rebuild villages along the Casino line and then on into Hungary for 6 months. So he was 7 years before he got back to college and to finish his degree, but that's the story of my brothers. And
were you aware, you know, you would have been younger than your brothers, were you?
I was older.
You were older,
2 years
yes.
older, yeah.
You know, I wonder what the concern in the family was when they were COs in the war. You know, what the public attitudes would have been mm-hmm. in America, in your part of America.
Mm-hmm. We were in a Quaker community with firm roots. It had been fed, this new area in Idaho had been fed to from communities, similar communities in Iowa, Indiana, Nebraska. And so it was an intentional Quaker community. I can't give you the figures on how many conscientious objectors came out of it, but my brothers could do no other, I'm sure. They just they understood that war was not possible for them. But they were willing to do other things, to do what they were allowed to do. And, of course, I married that kind of person.
So I understand. I wonder about yourself, you know, how old would you have been when World War II started, you know, the end of 1941?
I was 24.
Do you remember Pearl Harbor happening?
Yes. By that time, I was at grad school with Lewis in Michigan. We were married, and he had been deferred to get his as a student. So that's where we were, and we heard it on the radio. Lewis, as a historian, understood and explained to me exactly what it was going to mean. It was a very serious consideration as to what was coming next for us as well. But, of course, then life went on for us. He finished his student deferment and was given a teaching deferment. And that was partially, maybe he told you, because his local draft board in Oregon just didn't want a CO on their record. So.
Yes, that sort of indicates something about public, non-Quaker, that is, public
yes.
attitudes.
Yes.
I wonder if you've had any of this to put up with. You know, did you ever experience any hostility?
I think not. We were in something of a Quaker settlement in Newburgh, Oregon, where we went to teach. We did volunteer and take our part in plane spotting, going up in a little tower for a night duty to watch for planes that might come in off the coast because we were 65 miles from the coast. When I think about that, I think that we felt we could do that much of a civilian duty. Protection.
You know, you have explained how you met Lewis and were married at this time.
Mm-hmm.
But am I right in thinking that American women, you were not conscripted in the same way as happened in Britain?
No. It changed the West. The city of Portland, which was such a beautiful city there in the shadow of the mountain peaks under the sky and with the river flowing through, was changed forever by the war, We were about 20 miles from Portland, and our little town probably had its share of recruitment for the Army. I don't remember too much about it. I'm sure we were buying war. They were buying war bonds and doing all the usual things. But what happened to Portland was that the shipbuilding industry came, and it brought garment workers from New York City. It brought black people from across the United States, where there had not been a black population before. And Portland did not return to its original self ever again. And it is still a city that we love. And they've had just more of their particular problems to deal with, as every city has. And I wouldn't blame it on any of these things, but it did change.
Well, was there any peace activity as such, you know, in your area? You know, were sort of meetings or demonstrations held against the war throughout the war period, would you think?
No, I can't think of any such thing. No. We followed the progress of the war with dismay, and we knew that the devastation was going to be terrible. I can't be sure that we had any more interest in China than any other, or than in Europe, certainly, until Lewis was asked if he would be willing to volunteer to go to China. It came as a surprise to me.
Yes. Did you have any children at that time, Lewis?
We had our first child that first year that we were teaching in Oregon, and that was 44, and a little girl, and she was 16 months when Lewis left for China. And we made that commitment for a 2-year separation. I stayed at Pendle Hill, which was a mitigating factor, certainly.
What did you really think about going to China? You know, were you behind it? Did you understand the reasons why he went?
Yes, indeed, I did. And that sort of thing was happening very much. That's one reason why we went to Pendle Hill, and I didn't stay in Oregon near parents. It's because we knew that that's where the American Friends Service was, Philadelphia, and the work was being administered from there. People were going out from there, and young people flocked in to volunteer to go abroad to help pick up after the war. And Pendle Hill became an orientation center, Philadelphia and Pendle Hill. The service committee was putting the bill for this, and the training was done by people who had had experience before and people who knew the languages and such, and it was a very interesting time to be there. Some of those young people who passed through have been our lifelong friends, of course, because we shared experiences. Some romances were made there. Sometimes one went off to Finland and one went to China, and they didn't get together until years later. But the interesting thing was that after Lewis had been in China for about a year, the director of Pendle Hill, co-director with her husband, Anna Brinton, was asked to go out to do a little survey of Asia, East Asia, to see what friends might be doing there. They knew there was great need. And so she visited all of the projects of the FAU. She went wherever, and by any means of transportation that was necessary to get her there. She rode in boxcars. She caught the mumps in Chongqing and waited that out. And she was a woman past 65 at the time that she came. And she was very close to the men, young men and women that were there. She must have talked to Lewis quite a bit. She came home and she said, "Lois, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't be out there with Lewis." And then she said, "Don't you feel a concern to work in China?" And that seems laughable now. Of course I did. But I hadn't thought it possible at all. And I had to be content with just hearing about it from some of the returned workers and bringing messages, of course, and taking them out. But I was so excited then, and it took a lot of patience to wait it out to see whether it could really be done. But she said, I'll speak to the personnel office in the service committee and bring you an application form. And so sometime later, I met her on the path, and I said, Anna Brinton, is anything happening? And she said, I'm nursing it every 4 hours. And that's one of the things I treasure. So I don't remember in terms of months how long it was, but by December, I was appointed and ready to go out with the Friends International Center in Shanghai.
Did you have any training? No, were you given any language training or any other preparation for China, I wonder?
No, not language training. And we knew that the new crew that was being appointed to staff the center was an international one. The director was from New Zealand, a Scottish woman. And the secretary was Chinese. There was an American from North Carolina and others. It was a very interesting balance of staff. And we were to occupy the hostel that had been purchased by the Joint Service Committees of America and Britain, the first and only one, I believe, that they really purchased in all of the cities that they established centers in. And there was much need in Europe, of course, with the refugees. But they had been paying high rent for just an apartment and crowding people in. When the people came down from upcountry for any reason, to go home or to come out or to see the doctors or whatever reason, they were all crowded into this little flat, and they had one ama taking care of them, so that they assessed it and realized they really should have a larger place. So they bought a large building, residence, out on the edge of Hongkou Park, which was just a big open parade ground at that time. Four stories with big square high-ceilinged rooms. It had been occupied by the Japanese. They had taken out all the heating pipes, sent them home. But essentially, it was a place where we could make dormitories of big rooms, and the married couples could have a room to themselves. There were large rooms for meetings, and there was a little room for a quiet room. The first floor was all kitchen staff and storage, and there was a garden. This was a place where I could take my child, where we could be together, because Lewis was assigned then to a post in with the unit in Shanghai.
In the interim, you know, this year before you joined Lewis, you've had letters from him, I expect.
Oh, yes.
And was he keen for you to go? You know, his wife and child. Mm-hmm. He wasn't worried about China for a little baby at all.
No. We were young and brash. I think about it now. I'm sure we would have gone if we'd been older. People were doing it. But the absence had stretched out too long already, you know, and we were very glad to be able to share the experience. And that was something that Anna Brinton, in her wisdom, knew. She, and we saw it later, husbands who came home from working in the Gaza Strip, for instance, their wives said, I don't want to see another slide. I can't stand to see another slide. And it was an experience that they didn't share. It wasn't that they weren't sympathetic, but maybe it was jaundice, I don't know, because they hadn't shared it. But the interesting thing that has to be said now is that the nature of the work changed at that point from relief to reconstruction. And the title was changed, and even the Chinese characters were changed on the flashes on the uniforms.
Were you actually made part of the FAU?
No. I had an identity with the American Friends Service Committee and the British Service Committee. No. But changing from relief to reconstruction meant that they realized they needed, or that they could recruit married couples who might be willing to make a longer commitment and a more satisfactory one. And it meant that all those unit members who had had to remain single could get married and stay on instead of waiting until they got home. So we had at least 4 weddings at the hostel that first year that I was there. And by the second year, there were 4 babies. And one of them was our second one. And I know when I left Pendle Hill, Anna Brinton said to me, now I suppose that you and Lewis will be wanting to continue your family when you get to China. I said, oh no, Anna Brinton, we wouldn't do that to our service committee commitment. But I remember writing to her after the baby was born and saying, and now that she is here, she is her own excuse for being. Please send me the baby clothes in the trunk in the attic. But I'm sure it must have cut down on our efficiency somewhat. And, of course, the serving staff were then much involved with the laundry. It was a very fine experience for us young mothers, the best of my 4, because we had a Chinese doctor who was dedicated to us because he knew the work that had been done by friends during the war, although he thought we shouldn't be helping the Japanese. They had treated him badly, but he was an obstetrician, and he had stayed on because babies were being born, and the Chinese had confiscated his car and his radio and slapped him around, but he continued to operate his nursing home and use a bicycle. So he would not take a cent for his care of us, and he took us home to his own house for lunch on the day each month that we went for our checkups, and just lavished care on us and interest. We hunted the city for delicacies that were from his home province, and he was very kind to us. He had been trained in the mission hospital in Canton by William Cadbury at that earlier time. His boys had come over to Haverford to the States.
What was your role, actually, in the hostel? What were you there to do?
I was called the warden. And there was a lot to be done because we had quite a staff. We had an old ama, she was called. She had returned to the house. It had been owned by an American who had a Chinese wife and 7 children. And she had worked there as a younger woman. She came back to help with the cleaning, and she would be on the stairs sweeping, brushing down the stairs as we would go down to breakfast. And her rich old voice would say, good morning, missy. Good morning, master. And we just couldn't stand it. But it was there. And we had a houseboy. We had a first cook and a second cook, and they were brothers. And the first cook had come in off the road with the transport boys, had been taught to make steak and kidney pudding, steamed on an open fire. Delicious, too. And we always, when we had crepe Suzette, we had orange marmalade, very British. So we learned some things about British cuisine from him. And I took over the supervision of the meal planning. Had to teach him quite a lot because I didn't know about the food so much that he knew. But between us, we managed to try to please everyone. His brother would prepare the noon meal, and that was always Chinese. And our little one, the one who was 2 1/2 when I took her out, didn't like Chinese food, so she always had rice pudding. Rice and with a little boiled milk and some jam on it. That was her lunch every day. And the grandparents may have worried about us, but we felt that we had not put our children in jeopardy, nor ourselves, really. Medical care was one of the things the service committee felt was important.
Your hostel, you know, it would seem from what you had described from the situation before it was founded that this was going to be very important for the FAU, you know, to have this base.
Yes.
And as you've said, the quiet room and the rest of it. Did that prove to be, Lewis? You know, was it important?
Yes. And it was a special privilege to the staff of the center also to meet the fellows when they came and went. We always had a large table full at dinner. It could be anywhere from a dozen to three dozen. And there was a good interchange with other relief organizations in Shanghai. It was a very chaotic time. And the friends were running what they called a receiving home for children because the police didn't know what to do with the refugee children on the streets. So it was an old dairy that was used for that. And the children were set to work cleaning the rice, taking the sticks and pebbles out, and helping to keep themselves clean and all of that. And they had a wonderful Chinese woman who was the daughter of a minister, Evelyn Mary Herman, who with her husband Ted are still here in the States. And then students were coming back from, I could tell you a little about the things that fell to our doing at the center. Students had come back from carrying their universities to the West, and they were housed in very poor situation out at Fudan University, which was about 3 miles farther out of the city beyond us, 3 or 4 miles. And the students would walk in to have an hour of conversation with us. And on Thursday afternoons, we always had public tea. And I've seen a Chinese student pick up the milk pitcher and pour it into his cup and drink the lot. But we knew how little they had to eat, a rice ration, and goodness knows what else. And there was, so we had classes with the students, and we talked about their country, and they were often apologizing for their poor country that couldn't stop fighting and get on with catching up with the rest of the world. They were saying it even then, and we knew that there were still, even when the communists had pretty much won the hearts of the people, there were students who had still hoped for other solutions and were being sometimes snatched off by the nationalists because they were thought to be dissident and subversive because they suggested these alternatives. And everything was being poured into this civil war toward the latter part of the time that we were there.
Did you yourself, did you meet the nationalists, through people from the Kuomintang? Did they ever, you know, when you had your meals around the table, did you ever entertain within the hostel?
Not to my knowledge. Well, I suppose Lewis has told you, upcountry, and in previous days, some of the leaders had come around on a quiet Sunday afternoon for some companionship, but those are names to me. I never met any of them.
Were you aware of the situation there, Lewis? You know, the political business about, you know, between the Kuomintang, the communists, and what General Marshall was trying to achieve?
I was pretty well informed by Lewis and the conversation.
And the work he was doing, you know, as a go-between, it would seem, wouldn't
yes.
it?
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. I had it in simplistic form, I think, and only afterward did I know more about it. But it was that we knew that we needed passes so that the hospital work could continue on both sides of the line. And important work had been done in this model village of Jiangmu, which could so easily be just destroyed in a moment by ruthless armies. So they needed, for their own safety, too, to have this permission. And although Lewis was not any longer in that part of China, but was safe down in Shanghai, presumably, it was thought that they should send the responsible people. And so he was one of those, and I was proud to have him chosen.
Is how about these trips, which he's described so well to me, you know, two in particular, when he had to go up to see one of the communist leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me about that from your side? For instance, when he set off, did you have any idea how long he would be away?
No, certainly not. And our child, our baby, was about 5 months old, I think, when he left. And the thing, chief regret that I had was that the bonding was interrupted so for so such a long time. He was very well bonded to his first child. and this made some difference, I think, in their lives later on.
Were you worried? You know, when it
I had no idea what they were going through. But in a way, it was all of a piece with his experience before I got to China, because he was in very rugged circumstances then and wrote letters about it. And, you know, I knew that sometimes they got sore throats from the dust, but they were also pretty well surrounded by doctors. And things, if they went really bad, they'd be sent home. And nobody wanted that, really. So I think some of my colleagues thought that I was under stress because they gave me a holiday for a week during that time that he was gone, and I went over to a little house on Avenue Joffre where I had my own cook and took the little girls and just spent the time there in the garden. But I didn't find that so relaxing because I was cut off from information. And one was kept busy. You had to get on with your job. I had no idea that I was giving Lewis up, you know, for a lifetime, and yet lesser circumstances than that have separated couples, just cut things off.
When the Lady Cripps's mission went through China, were you there at that time?
Oh, I think not. Do you know what year that would have been?
Yes, I suppose it was before you went. It was 46 or 47.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been probably before you went, wouldn't it?
Perhaps.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I wondered if you met any other interesting people while you were in China. You know, if you can think of any Chinese. Did you ever meet Madame Sun Yat-sen? I know Lewis mentioned her in passing, but I didn't have the opportunity
Say that I did. We visited in 87, in the fall, we visited her house in, was it Beijing or Shanghai, which has been kept as a monument, a memorial, pictures of her marriage and of their stories of their courtship and the years that followed. And I feel great interest in her, of course.
The other thing I was going to ask, you know, the people who came through your hostel, what was the proportion of women then? Roughly, you know,
well,
two
there
men.
Was one wife to each husband, practically, at that time.
Most of the couples, as you say, were getting married by then, yes.
And then we had the director of the Friends International Center, Mary Campbell, the Scottish woman who had emigrated to New Zealand. She was a character. She was the aunt of every young man there. And she had a voice that was pitched to be heard above the Scottish winds, I guess. It was so I can hear Mary any moment that I want to turn it on in my mind. She was, as I say, a wonderful character, and she continued to write from New Zealand after she went home. Her letters were pithy and full of reference to people that we knew, and we loved getting them, and she loved our children, too. So there were, among the representatives of other church groups, memorable people. Some of them we've met again in the United States. And, of course, Bill Sewell passed through briefly, and Harry Silcock was there when I first arrived. And then among the Americans, there's one person who later became president of one of the Mennonite colleges at Goshen, Indiana, who was invited to come back. And I think that the Mennonites may have had more direct identity with their old mission groups than almost any other. Certainly the Catholics were not allowed. But the Mennonites are such a mild and gentle people. And also efficient. And this man, we met him later at our college. he had become, after he'd become president at Goshen. And he and his wife were just the same people that we had known. I had gone home on the same boat with her, with the baby who was 13 months old when we went home. And we stopped in the harbor of Yokosuka, our boat did, for 4 days. And we're just sitting there, and I thought I couldn't get off the boat because I couldn't take the child. It was an hour's ride by train to Tokyo, and Japan was very much occupied. But this dear mother, who had children of her own on the boat, said, "I'll keep Laurie, and you go and see the city." So I had that opportunity because of her.
So you went to Tokyo?
Yes.
This would be in 48. Yes, what was it like then, Tokyo, you know, after the bombing? Had they reconstructed, done much?
I think they had quite a bit. Things looked so neat and tidy as compared with China. China was anticipating the arrival of the communists in the port cities, and they...